From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
The fact is that it was President Obama and the Congress who identified these seven countries. So President Trump is just following on.
That was Counselor to the President Kellyanne Conway on Monday, responding to a reporter's question asking how President Trump designated seven countries, Iraq, Iran, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen, in an executive order issued this weekend, suspending for 90 days a special visa program.
President Obama suspended the Iraq refugee program for 6 months in 2011, and no one certainly covered it. I think nobody noticed. He did that, I assume, because there were two Iraqis who came here, got radicalized, joined ISIS, and then were the masterminds behind the Bowling Green attack on our brave soldiers. And so this is what presidents do when they're trying to protect their country. President Obama did it, and now President Trump is doing it. President Obama identified these seven countries.
The executive order sparked protests at airports across the country. For more on those protests, we spoke with Danny Haifong, columnist at BlackAgendaReport.com, about a column of his coming out later this week entitled, What is to be Done? Crisis and Chaos in the Era of Trump. We spoke with him via Skype from Boston Sunday. Danny, a very interesting piece and a very interesting time. We are looking at crisis and chaos in the era of Trump and what is to be done.
Yeah, this is a very interesting moment. It seems like overnight since Trump was inaugurated as the next U.S. president, there have been protests all over the place in the United States, from the Democratic Party-funded Women's March to now the recent protests against Trump's executive order to place a temporary ban on refugees coming from a set number of countries that have a long history of being destabilized by prior administrations and their war designs. So what's interesting about this period right now is not just the fact that there are protests going on all over the country just in regards to Trump's mere presence in the White House, but that there is this almost resurgence and attempt by the Democratic Party to rebrand itself in the name of the quote-unquote people. What it's trying to do is lead these demonstrations from the head and channel and once again create a resume to for the people to become once again the appendages of what is, I think, still the more true expression of the ruling class in the U.S. imperialist system right now. So genuine radicals and progressives really need to resist the urge to just follow along and allow the Democratic Party to take people who may be genuinely concerned about, you know, Trump's proposals to reinstate CIA black sites, to build this quote-unquote border wall, to reinstate the Dakota Access and Keystone XL pipelines, and start to, as we resist that urge to primarily focus all of our attention on the fear of Trump, start to build a resistance that can explain to the people what brought us here, but more importantly, what the prospect of having the establishment Democratic Party and the establishment Republican Party once again take back Washington and create, and begin to once again recreate the world in its image.
You know, we're looking at the airport protests over the weekend, and they're massive, and I keep going through images of what I've had to do at airports and trying to figure out how I would organize a protest at an airport, let alone at a few dozen airports, and what kind of work goes into that organization and such. And a lot of people are there for the reason that they're saying, which is that they think that this is, a violation of people's human rights, and they're there to defend them. They're not going to put up with it. And a lot of them also see some major change in policy with respect to, for example, immigration from Trump to from Obama to Trump, although Obama deported more people than any previous president. And in addition to that, when Trump's executive order that's being protested rests upon a statute that has all of the countries except Syria listed in it as worthy of special attention already. I'm wondering, looking at the change of policy that the United States apparently has begun, we see that they hit Al-Qaeda in Yemen, where before Al-Qaeda was attacking the people of Yemen, basically, who've taken control of their country, more or less in conjunction with the Saudis, who have been doing the aerial campaign, playing the role the U.S. played in Libya with Al-Qaeda as the ground forces. Suddenly the U.S. hits Al-Qaeda. And, we have seen already, even before Putin and Trump spoke about it on Saturday, the U.S. and Russia doing coordinated attacks on ISIS in Syria and Iraq, or in Syria in any event. So I'm wondering if the change of policy where Al-Qaeda is suddenly the enemy, actually generates some... it would make sense that there would be in the countries where the U.S. has been more or less fighting with Al-Qaeda or other terrorist groups, suddenly if the U.S. is going to be their antagonist, if the security doesn't warrant some extra level of scrutiny.
Yeah, no, what you're saying is completely sensible. Right now, there is such a high volume of emotion being poured into the resistance against Trump. And the real concern that I have with that is not that somehow do I think that the Trump administration or the GOP that, is both aligning and also plotting how to destabilize Trump is somehow going to dramatically improve things in the United States and around the world. But I think the danger of it is the fact that it kind of clouds a sober understanding of the geopolitical situation in the broader economic crisis that U.S. imperialism is currently experiencing. And part of that crisis is related to what prior administrations have done in regions of the world that are now being targeted by Trump as so-called terror sites. And if we look at the policy, of what Trump is instituting, we can see that from his campaign standpoint, it makes complete sense to target these countries that the U.S. has sponsored scores of terrorists in order to destabilize them and institute a policy that allows for a temporary hold on immigration in order to confront that very problem. And it seems like this move to collaborate with Russia on the anti-terror front, the counter-terror front, completely complements that policy. So while at the same time, we don't necessarily have to agree and we can resist on a broad, maybe moralistic standpoint that banning immigration is xenophobic and racist
Personally, I don't. I think there should be no borders. Okay, that's my the working class should be allowed to go wherever it wants because capital certainly is allowed to, and it's used for exactly in exactly that way. But and I'm thinking also, maybe they ought to take some payroll records from Langley and run it against the visa list because he probably knock out like 99% of the actual terrorists by just doing that. But you can identify them from the CIA's payroll lists. But going to the point of this, you've got if the U.S. is turning its guns on Al-Qaeda and ISIS in these different places, which is where they're operating, then they're going to flee. And you certainly want to know if they're coming into the country, you'd think.
Yeah, it's completely sensible in that respect. Of course, it remains to be seen what will actually turn out, what will actually happen in this situation, given that the U.S. military state has been completely committed to fostering, fomenting, and developing mercenary terrorism in that region. And to stop it is a complete threat to the hegemonic ambitions of the military state. So it remains to be seen what's going to happen if the policies that Trump is leaning towards and signaling towards actually go into effect, both on the domestic and international front. And also the domestic protests, which, you know, if we look at this from a broader political perspective, you know, will have leverage in that it is a very principled and desirable position to take, that, you know, immigrants should, you know, people all over the world should have the right to travel wherever, and they should not be targeted for any specific reasons. That's principled, but at the same time, we're working from a very objective political condition in the world right now, and Donald Trump has specific promises that he has to keep in order to just survive in the White House. So we better expect, and we can see from the last, you know, just week or so, that Donald Trump is trying to make good on every one of those promises in order to remain legitimate in the eyes of his supporters and fight back a lot of the pressure that is being laid on him to concede his position and his program to the you know, to the capitalist class that ultimately lost the election. So we're in a very interesting moment. I think probably the biggest danger right now is that while there will be a lot of legitimate things to protest from the GOP and the Trump administration, there is a seemingly lackadaisical, if not completely blind, ignorance over the fact that the Democratic Party is the party of Wall Street and war, and it has so many resources at its disposal to turn this new so-called insurgency into merely a pressure release for the next time the Democratic Party wants to roll out a candidate, regardless of whether that's if Trump isn't able to last, and then, you know, Pence replaces him, and then there's this big push to get ready for the midterms and also 2020, or whether it's just waiting until 2020 to have the strongest candidate as possible to then say, look at all the victories that we scored while the working class remains mired in misery.
You know, you wrote the following, and I want to raise something with it on the point you just made. Genuine radicals and progressives need to resist the urge to condemn Trump's withdrawal from the TPP or his desire to build friendlier relations with Russia. Now, I haven't seen so much about that, the TPP part, but, you know, among these protesters, do you have, like we saw down in Washington, you know, people that had hammers and sickles on Trump posters, meaning it as an insult that he, you know, that he's a puppet of the Kremlin, I guess, or whatever. And, you know, you look around at these rallies and you see people like Gerald Nadler and others or the CBC. And you say, as Vladimir Lenin asked in 1902, movement organizers must confront the question of what is to be done in the midst of these conditions, and that an objective assessment must be formulated to explain to the people exactly why someone like Trump would pursue what he's pursuing. And that, of course, he should be fought every step of the way on his attacks on women, Muslims, undocumented immigrants, etc. But watch out for the Democratic Party, because they're at the heart, they're involved in this. Now, see, I'm not looking at 2020 or even 2018 midterms. I'm looking at a coup that's been, you know, rolling on since at least November 8th. And the context that, you know, with that as context to what's happening, if people are able to provoke, and I'm seeing people, usually pretty sane people, calling for, you know, for a coup, in essence, for Trump's removal. I mean, he's been president a week. and I'm wondering what people think, you know, in terms of what is to be done. You know, you end up in this condition that looks like a revolutionary condition. Where exactly is your organization? What's your program? You know, all of the things that Lenin lay out when he, in what is to be done. Where's the critique of the various players in depth, their history, the role that they're playing now, where they would take things, you know, the assessment of forces, of assets and resources available? You know, there's none of this. Somebody, if somebody has it, it's a secret. And there's no actual work going on in the working class on these matters, which means that whoever's best organized in a condition of chaos is going to win the day. And it seems to me that the ones that are organized that way are the people who just lost the election, and in my opinion, on the issue of war with Russia and jobs.
Yeah, and that's the big danger of this moment. You know, Lenin, what he was talking about and what is to be done was how to build a party, how to build a political party of the working class. And what that really required was an understanding of all the broad forces within Russian society that would ultimately impede that, and what needed to be done in order to draw away working class people from those bankrupt institutions like the labor aristocracy, for example, or the social democrats in Russia, which were playing at revolution and then advocating for, you know, ultimately what would be just a reform of the autocratic state. So we have to sort of take that analysis and look at the current landscape here in the United States, where we just ended an electoral period where there were millions of people, whether in their votes for Trump, whether in their votes for Sanders, whether in their whether in their votes for nobody, showed that they are actually sick and tired of the condition that they are living in from a material perspective, from the perspective of being a working class person mired in debt, in low wage jobs, watching billions and billions of dollars being spent on wars and bank bailouts. And then hearing the Democratic Party consistently use this anti-Russia, neo-McCarthyist narrative in order to justify their, you know, morally righteous position, yet offer nothing to the people generally. What we now see is that there's a lack of this analysis going on. There was a lack of it going on during the electoral period. And now that Trump is presidency, it seems like a lot of people have kind of dropped any analytical perspective on the moment in order to get behind what is going to be. And I hope that a lot of genuine radicals and revolutionaries and organizers of all stripes hear this. It's going to be Democratic Party led, and even maybe some GOP establishment elements within that. We have to look at this from an objective perspective and who and what has political power at this moment. Right now, the organized left does not have political power. What does have political power is the nonprofit industrial complex, the Democratic Party, and all of its Wall Street and military contractor millions. And ultimately, that is probably going to be the biggest challenge to developing a working class program and a working class party in this period where all of our attention is turned to Donald Trump. So we have quite the work to do, quite a lot of work to do. And
you can say that.
It's one thing to, and I think a lot of people are getting confused. It's one thing to condemn protesters. I see people all over social media saying, why are you condemning protesters for not being out during the Obama era? And now you're condemning them for being out on the streets during the Trump era. It's not a matter of condemning protesters for, you know, speaking out against things that they see as unprincipled and against their, against their standards. What is important and what this should be about is looking at the objective conditions in front of us and understanding that there will be a lot of forces within these demonstrations that are actually seeking, whether, you know, subconsciously or whether very consciously and directly, to lead us right back into the Democratic Party trap, lead us right back into paralysis in the face of the greatest and largest crisis that U.S. imperialism, both on the domestic and international front, has ever experienced.
You know, since you invoked it in the title of your piece, it's an interesting sentence in the introduction to chapter two of Lenin's What Is to Be Done, the spontaneity of the masses and the consciousness of the social democrats. And Lenin says, the question of the relation between consciousness and spontaneity is of such enormous general interest that must be dealt with in great detail. In other words, you have to do a detailed analysis of exactly what is going on inside the heads and the actions and the sudden uprising of the workers, if that's what we're seeing. And, you know, it's interesting that, you know, I've noticed this massive, you know, organizing effort being expressed in the most difficult venue possible, legally, you know, militarily, police-wise, whatever, airports, the highest security spots in the country. If these are, in fact, representative of a worker uprising, let's leave the airports and have the revolution, because the people are ready. You know, let's raise the demands of worker control of production. Let's raise the demands of demilitarization, all of that, and go in the streets in these numbers over that, if that's where things are at. But I don't think things are there. That's my point. The organizing seems to be, you know, from structures, not from spontaneity. And who owns those structures? The workers haven't organized those structures.
No, they're completely, you know, in Boston, most of these demonstrations are being led by the nonprofit entrenched establishment that, when you look at their payrolls, you look at who's exactly paying these institutions, it always goes back to some Democratic Party affiliate, surrogate, or politician generally. So right now, yes, we have to understand the leadership of these demonstrations is Democratic Party in character, because if we do not, we will run the risk of allowing all of the forces that are in the streets right now to be used as cannon fodder for the agenda of the, you know, imperialist system. That is always the danger, and we see we have to look at spontaneity, and I think spontaneity has actually become a pretty interesting and well-spoken about topic of late, in that most of the protests and demonstrations and movements that have occurred over the last, you know, since Occupy have all been called spontaneous, have all been called, you know, things that kind of emerge out of a reaction to certain conditions, whether it was, you know, the Wall Street bailouts during the Occupy Wall Street movement, or whether it was the murder of Black Americans by the police and the Black Lives Matter movement. But there was one thing that was different about those movements than the one that we are seeing right now. What was different in those movements is that the spontaneity came from people who were not connected to the Democratic Party machinery, and it had to be the Democratic Party machinery to then infiltrate and attempt to squash those movements, which, you know, we can argue whether they were successful in doing or not. But right now, what we're seeing is a reaction by the Democratic Party right after an electoral loss, channeling and using all of their resources necessary to what I call stealthily hide among the masses who they are trying to spark and inculcate this fear into, in order to achieve their political objectives in the long term. And what we're seeing is, you know, a really important moment that we have to sit down together and talk about. We have to talk about how are we going to resist this anti-Russia narrative? How are we going to resist the Democratic Party? You know, Margaret Kimberly said it last Thursday, the movement first, the Black movement first, has to address the Black missing leadership class. Well, I will say that the left, people who are genuinely, who genuinely want to see social transformation and revolution in our lifetime, have to address the Democratic Party first. That doesn't mean ignore whatever Trump does, whatever the administration does, as long as he is in office. What it means is that First, what produced this very moment we are in, it was 8 years and arguably 30 years of U.S. imperialist crisis managed by the Democratic Party and Republican Party elite. And that's who we have to target. And the Democratic Party is the so-called representative of the constituencies that we need to win over in order to make a social revolution in our time. So that is the task, in my opinion.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned, this narrative, particularly about Russia, presents a danger to the world, not seen since the Cold War. And that the fact that both Democrats and Republicans see, war with Russia as a necessary precondition to hegemony by the U.S. means that there's the bonus floating this for the ruling class, but it needs to be publicly condemned by the grassroots inside and outside of the anti-Trump insurgency because of the stakes are survival of the species, in essence.
Exactly, and there are a lot of people on the left who are excited about these anti-Trump demonstrations, by these demonstrations against some of his more concrete executive orders. And I guess the message is not to not be excited about those things. But what we really have to, there's only going to be a set number of people within and outside of those marches that are advanced enough right now in their political consciousness to think about what I think are the critical questions. The question is, how do we move from, condemning Trump for his quote-unquote illegitimacy, whether that's he's just embarrassing to the ruling class, whether that's these lies about him being affiliated with Russia, or whether it's because of his racist rhetoric or whatever it is that ultimately soils this image of American exceptionalism in a lot of minds of liberal Americans. How do we get from that kind of resistance to the resistance where we are actually upholding a program of the working class, a program of oppressed people that puts healthcare, that puts war, that puts the mass black incarceration state, that puts a lot, that puts that puts jobs, that puts demands that ultimately cannot be won and cannot be instituted by the current state apparatus that is completely in service of the capitalist and imperialist system. How do we get to there so we can actually start to build that broad-based movement that we need that is capable of politically educating masses of people towards what I think must be done in order to actually rid of the miserable conditions on this earth, which is a revolution in the United States, a revolution that takes hold of production and and completely transforms it based on the needs of the people and away from and suppresses the compulsion for the profits of the few, the profits of those who wield private property. That's my question right now. How do we get from that point to this point? And, and it's something that we're going to have to discuss as things continue to develop.
Danny Haifong is a columnist and a regular contributor to BlackAgendaReport.com. We've been discussing his column for this week, What is to be Done? Crisis and Chaos in the Era of Trump. Danny, thank you very much. A pleasure as always.
Thank you, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.